Our first speaker tonight, I have known for many, many years. I sat at his feet while I was a student at Springfield in several classes in German, in catechetics, in liturgics, and I was privileged to sing both in the seminary chorus and in the a cappella chorus, which was a mixed group, both under the excellent direction of Professor Fred Precht. After I left the seminary in Springfield, sometime later, he became director of the Lutheran Church Missouri Foundation. He went back again to the Springfield Seminary and became the director of seminary relations. He has returned again to the St. Louis area, where he presently serves as director of the foundation of the World Home Bible League. So you see, he does have quite a vast background and a very strong interest and knowledge in the area of liturgics in worship. He is presently on the Liturgical Music Committee, which is a subcommittee of the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship. Dr. Precht, we're very happy to have you here tonight.
After that introduction, I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say. May the Lord forgive Brother Schmidt for those excesses and me for enjoying them. The story is told that Pastor Schmidt, while serving a small, struggling congregation somewhere out east during his early years, came to the first quarterly meeting of the voters suggesting that the church be refurbished because it looked rather bad. And in the course of that meeting, when he made that suggestion, one man got up and said that what the chancel needed was the new chandelier. Another man immediately rose to his feet and objected, saying that first of all, this item was too expensive, and secondly, there was no one in the congregation who could play it. Furthermore, what this church needed was more light. And this evening, I feel I'm privileged to be here, possibly to shed a little light upon a very, very important subject confronting our church. I hope, God forbid, that I don't generate any heat. So, if you take your outlines, we'll do a little speaking to this point. You have to realize, I think, that adequately to cover the material within this brief span of, say, 45 minutes is a formidable task. And last autumn, when I spoke to various pastoral conferences on this subject, we spent 3.5 hours. And this is a project that's been in the works for 10 years, and it cost the synod, I think, around $300,000 so far. It's been an extremely important project. When I was invited to make this presentation, the committee in charge suggested I treat the matter under three headings. First, how did this hymnal come into being? Secondly, on what basis were the hymns and liturgical materials selected? And thirdly, what are some of the hymnal's pros and cons? Now to the first point. How did this hymnal come into being? And here I must mention, first of all, the Lutheran hymnal, 1941. The hymnal out of which you just sang, Walter's hymn, He Is Risen. This hymnal, as I said, was published in 1941. It was the successor to the Evangelical Lutheran Hymn Book, which appeared in 1911, but really which was issued earlier than that. It came out of the English Conference in 1889 already. Generally speaking, the life of a hymnal is around 25, 35, 40 years. And in 1962, our Synod's Commission on Worship, taking its cue from various synodical resolutions and overtures, demanding that the Synod broaden the scope of its liturgical and hymnological material, our Synod's Commission on Worship decided to embark upon the process of revising this present hymnal, the 1941 hymnal. However, in 1965, the Synod, assembled in convention in Detroit, instructed the Synod's president, Dr. Oliver Harms, to invite other church bodies, other Lutheran bodies in America, to work with the Missouri Synod in the production of common worship materials, including, of course, both liturgical materials and hymnic materials. The following church bodies accepted that invitation: the American Lutheran Church, the ALC, the Lutheran Church in America, the LCA, the Synod of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, which of course is part of us, SELC, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada, which was formerly part of the ALC, but which a little later in 1967 became a separate entity. And at this point, it should be mentioned that in 1958, this invitation went out in 65. In 1958, there appeared this book, namely the Service Book and Hymnal, SBH, which was produced by the various Lutheran church bodies now comprising the LCA and the ALC. Note, for instance, that the invitation went out in 65, just about 7 years after this book was published. And those church bodies accepted the invitation then to embark already at this early stage into a new hymnal project. Well, the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship thereafter was organized and formulated in the fall of 1966. The first meeting was held in Chicago, where representatives of these participating bodies came and became organized. And this organization then was given the mandate by the participating current bodies to produce a new hymnal for these various Lutheran bodies. With regard to the structure, I don't think that we should say much about it in that, the structure of this ILCW. In brief, I might say that it was very tightly and intelligently organized. It had a constitution which was formulated. It consisted of 8 representatives or commissioners from each of the participating bodies. It had especially 4 standing committees which were concerned with the hymn text, the hymn music, the liturgical text, and the liturgical music. Those are the basic committees. And they did, of course, the bulk of the work for this particular product. Then there were, of course, review committees that, as things developed and things were produced, each participating body had a review committee of about 10 people chosen by the respective presidents who reviewed all the materials that were being produced. And in that day, in those early years, the ILCW embarked upon producing volumes which were called contemporary worship. They were really experimental in nature to try to ascertain what congregations, what these so-called 9, 10, 11 million Lutherans representing these bodies liked and disliked. And so these were produced. Then periodic reports were also made to the parent bodies so that they always knew what was going on. And then later on, about 3-4 years ago, through the generosity of Aid Association for Lutherans, a project director was named, and that's Dr. Eugene Brandt, who is out in New York City, and he's in the office where LACUSA is situated. Now, let's talk about a little about the proposed contents of this so-called Lutheran Book of Worship. At least that is the title which has been selected for it. LBW, Lutheran Book of Worship. And I thought it might be interesting to you, although we're not going to dwell upon this, just to see what's going to be included in this book. If you will look under 1 of C, you'll see a brief order for confession and forgiveness, the Holy Communion, propers for Sundays and festivals, additional prayers, holy baptism, confirmation, reception into membership, restoration, marriage and propers, burial and propers, service of the word, which is really a Predigtgottesdienst. See, it's an abbreviated service which stresses largely the preaching, the reading of scriptures, the singing of hymns and so forth, and prayers. It's a Predigtgottesdienst, a preaching service. We have matins, vespers, compline, service of confession and forgiveness, responsive prayer, litany, daily lectionary, and the Psalms. This gives you some idea. So if we call it, you might say it is a service book in a sense, and that has a lot more liturgical material possibly than what our present book has. And then, of course, it has, as far as hymnody is concerned, at this point, in this stage, there are about 530 hymns to be contained in this particular volume. Then there are proposed certain auxiliary books also. There is, for instance, an altar book for pastors. And these things will evidently, depending upon the situation, be produced later. There is a liturgical accompaniment book. That means a special book for the organist, which he uses to accompany the parts of the liturgy and also the hymnody. And in that connection, I might say that the hymns in this book and the liturgical accompaniments exhibit some very fine musicianship, some scholarly musicianship, I believe. I cannot help but be reminded of, say, the Lutheran hymnal that came out in 41, and the harmonizations. Oh, I better. I'm so okay. The harmonizations, shall we say, are very, very difficult to play, particularly using the pedal and the organ. And in those early years, Valparaiso used to put on yearly so-called liturgical conferences. In fact, they still do, or church music seminars. And I can recall that at practically every session, there was someone there, or there was a section on the program, how to play the hymns and the Lutheran hymnal on the organ, because of the type of harmonization. I'm not, you might say, deprecating it, because personally I like some of the harmonizations very much, but I think that you find that the hymns and the musical portions of this particular proposed book are rather well done. I think that we've learned a lot since the production of the 1941 hymnal, to be very frank with you. Well, there is also to be a liturgical manual for pastors, largely for their use, and undoubtedly a handbook to this Lutheran worship, book of worship, the same as we have a handbook to the Lutheran hymnal 1941. And the target date for the appearance of the Lutheran book of worship is Advent 1978. Now, that's not very far away. Now, to the next point. On what basis were the liturgical materials and hymns selected? First of all, the liturgical materials. Having been on that committee for 10 years, I would say that first and foremost, there was the concern that liturgical materials be scriptural in content, reflecting the theology of the Lutheran symbols. If, as one church divine has stated, the liturgy is our theology prayed and sung, and I thoroughly subscribe to this, then certainly the liturgy must reflect sound scriptural theology. This is the sine qua non. And because of this, the historic liturgical churches have insisted that in the preparation of their liturgies and hymnals, the churchmen and scholars entrusted with this task have studied and weighed every sentence, considered the finest points of capitalization and punctuation to secure not only all possible literary grace, but above all, a clear and consistent expression of doctrinal truth of the Christian faith. And as the second point, in very close conjunction with the foregoing, is the consideration also that the liturgy reflect the mind of Lutheranism. Briefly stated, there is a high interest today in matters of corporate worship. The rising flood of materialism, godlessness, and brutality threatens all moral and spiritual values, as you and I know so well. On the other hand, this flood has apparently increased the longing of Christians for spiritual reality in the house of God. Christians are seeking a solid anchor to hold their ship of life with its uncertainties in this world of chaos and turmoil and unrest. And thank God that Christians are increasingly realizing and believing that it is only in the gospel of Jesus Christ in which they can find purpose and meaning in this life and eternal salvation in the next. I think they realize that no matter what other activities the church may engage in, public worship is essential to its very life and mission. It is God's way of dealing with us in word and sacraments. But to this I would also say that liturgical revision must be integrated into the total mission and life of God's people. We dare not succumb to liturgical revision simply for its own sake. Liturgy isn't just for those who like that sort of thing. The liturgy is there because we need corporate expression of our identity as Christians in the gospel. First, God comes to us in Jesus Christ, in word and sacraments. And in faith, then, we obediently and joyously respond in remembrance and proclamation, in petition and thanksgiving, in offering and singing. Now, to the point of contemporary language. The numerous translations of the Bible that have appeared, say, in the past 10 years, give ample witness to the fact that Christians today strongly desire modern, idiomatic, easily readable, and intelligible language. Cognizant of this, of course, the liturgy and the hymns of the proposed book have also been brought in line with this desire. The these and thous are missing. The old verb forms. And so you'll find that the text has been modernized. Then also with regard to some of the text, we talk about the ICET text. I-C-E-T. For the past 10 years, a group of English scholars, or rather scholars from various denominations, but they met in England frequently, and particularly representing the English-speaking churches, has been meeting in England to work out present-day language for the ancient prayers, canticles, and liturgical texts. And this group is called the International Consultation on English Texts. The results of this work have been adopted by the Roman Catholic, the Methodist, the Anglican, Presbyterian, and Baptist churches. In fact, it is expected that eventually all the English-speaking churches will use what we call the ICET texts, even as we have all shared the same wording, for instance, of the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer. The ILC decided, of course, to use these texts, however, with two exceptions. In the Apostles' Creed, instead of the ICET reading, which says he descended to the dead, our present statement, he descended into hell, will be retained. Secondly, the Lord's Prayer is to be included in this hymnal in both readings, the traditional one that you and I know, and also the ICET text. And these latest revised texts are found in this little book, Prayers We Have in Common. So the ICET texts will show up in the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Sursum Corda, the Sanctus and Benedictus, the Agnus Dei, the Gloria Patri, the Benedictus, Te Deum, Magnificat, and Nunc Dimittis. We'll talk a little about those texts later. This book also has and has striven to afford congregations variety without disturbing the basic form of the worship service. To avoid confusing the worshipers, these different optional forms are immediately apparent to the worshipers, hopefully, by being boxed off in red, so that not a lot of confusion sets in, because I'm sure you and I have attended services where the parts of the liturgy were drawn from different sources, and we had maybe 2-3 books that we were coping with and pamphlets and whatnot. And this book also is an attempt to obviate that sort of thing so that it doesn't destroy the devotion of people. With regard to the liturgical music that you'll find in this book, it seems to me as though the first quality of any music for a liturgy is that it have unity in variety. As a good symphony composition, for instance, has this unity in variety in, say, its various parts. Maybe it's three parts or four parts. So also, unlike our present hymnal, the ILCW strove to have unity in variety. If you take a look at our present hymnal, if you can just for a moment think back, the music in that hymnal, and I think some of it's very good, let's say, for instance, Lord Have Mercy, the Kyrie. Lord have mercy upon us, you recall that? That was written by Martin Luther himself, adapted from Psalm Tone 1. It's a different style altogether than that which follows in the Gloria in Excelsis. Glory be to God on high, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. An altogether different style. That comes out of the Anglican Church. That's Anglican chant. And it's a flexible type of tune, and to allow for contraction and expansion. In the classroom, I was never accustomed to sticking to one place. I like to jump around, fouling me up a little bit here tonight. The credo, well, most of the time we recite that, don't we? The Sanctus, well, we all know that. The Holy, Holy, Holy. The Agnus Dei, of course, very fine piece of music coming out of the Reformation, modeled along chorale lines. Lamb of God that takest away the sin of the world, have mercy upon us. Beautiful piece of music. Christi du Lamm Gottes, der du trägst die Sünde der Welt. And then, of course, the Nunc Dimittis. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, which again is Anglican chant. Now, in this new hook, the German liturgy, for instance, I recall as a little boy, the old Missouri Synod and liturgy, we used largely versification or hymns for parts of the liturgy. When we sang the Kyrie, we sang, Kyrie, Gott Vater in Ewigkeit. You recall that hymn, hymn number 6 that we had. The Gloria, we sang what is sometimes referred to as Der Lutherische Walzer, the Lutheran Waltz. Allein Gott in der Heil sei er. You recall that? We sing it in English, too. By Decius, who is a monk and later became an evangelical pastor for the cause. The Credo. I can recall as a little boy, and I often wondered why every single Sunday we sang that same hymn. Wir glauben allein einen Gott. You recall that, don't you? The Sanctus. Well, we sang the melody that was present in our hymnal, but we also sang Luther's Sanctus. Jesaja den Propheten das Geschah. About 2 months ago, I had my nose fixed. Now I find that my vocal cords don't work so well. Well, those are different things that we did. Now, in the music of this proposed hymnal, we, for instance, are going to have three settings. In our present hymnal, we more or less have one setting for the order of the Holy Communion, don't we? And that is made up of some Lutheran chorale-like chants, and it's made up of largely of Anglican chants. But in the new book, it is proposed that one setting, for instance, will be a setting, a through-composed thing, not a mixtum compositum, but a through-composed thing. And the first one is by Richard Hillert, a prof in River Forest. Personally, I think he produced some very fine music. Maybe some of you have tried it. You've sung it. And I'll be interested after a while in hearing your reactions. The second setting is going to be by Ronald Nelson, a person of the ALC, an organist and choir master. And it's more, a little bit more, maybe hymn-like in quality. And the third setting is a plain song adaptation of a setting which is found in the service book and hymnal of the present ALC and ALCA. And it's a simplified form. It's a plain song. So there'll be three musical settings for congregations to choose, from which they might choose. See, some of them might like this setting, some that, so forth and so on. Now, with regard to the testing process, let me say that in the course of these 10 years, there was a constant review of the materials by the ILCW itself. The committees in charge of reviewing. The contemporary worship series, when they came out, the reactions to these were thoroughly considered. The volunteer testing on the part of congregations was solicited. The doctrinal review committees of the participating bodies studied the materials. The order of the Holy Communion, for instance, which is contained herein and which some of you possibly have done in some field testing, came out in 1971. It was pre-tested before it came out. It was tested after it came out. It was revised again. It was tested. And right now is presently, again, undergoing some testing by the congregations in the three participating bodies. And I will have to say this about the book. I don't think there's a single liturgical book proposed that has gone through so much testing and field testing and has received so much input and feedback and has absorbed and assimilated much of this feedback to make it, you might say, something that the people might favorably accept. Now, with regard to the hymn texts, some of the prime considerations, first of all, in this book, the hymns, there are about 530. It was the concern of the hymn text committee that those hymns be included which adequately support the worship of the church and sound scriptural theological requirements of such worship. For instance, in exemplifying the Christian year, the life of the church centering in word and sacraments, the life of the Christian in this world, faith, justification, sanctification, prayer, special occasions, also reflecting the Christian's responsibility to his fellowmen. Now, the individual hymn texts were generally examined according to four criteria. First of all, scripturalness. The question was asked, does this particular hymn forthrightly express or reflect the great truths of God in Jesus Christ, or is it vague and evanescent? That was a big question. The supreme being idea, we're all headed for the same place. Naturally, these concepts could find no place and would find no place in this sort of book. The Christian hymn must properly distinguish law and gospel. Then there was the matter of liturgical propriety. Because the hymn is such an important vehicle in public worship, it has to be decent, edifying, uplifting. It has to be orderly. After all, the hymn is not primarily to instruct, but especially also to awaken feelings of devotion. After all, the hymn is not primarily to instruct, but especially also to awaken feelings of devotion and reverence. Hence, vulgar, trivial, chuckle-provoking hymns have no place in a good Christian hymnal. Nor do over sugary, you might say, sweet sentimental types of hymns. To illustrate, in the Lutheran hymnal, number 464, one line originally read prior to this hymnal, the 41, when we asunder part, it gives us bitter pain. Well, that would hurt any one of us. So in the TLH it was changed to, "When here our pathways part." It gives us bitter pain, which was a great improvement. In the past, perhaps, calling a sinner a worm has undoubtedly been quite acceptable. For instance, the Lutheran hymnal, as you know, 154, "Alas, and did my Savior bleed." It's a beautiful hymn. The first stanza winds up with, "For such a worm as I." Today, that concept of worm gives you a funny little feeling. So I noticed that the editors who worked on this particular hymn simply changed it to, "Such a sinner as I," which avoids that sort of thing. In the 18th century, English-speaking Christians thought nothing of singing, for instance. In one of their hymns, talking about Elijah, Enoch, they sang, "Up the deathless way to glory, where the holy seraphs burn. Enoch traveled by translation, with no ticket to return." Didn't bother them a bit. You recall the pericope for Palm Sunday with the Christ riding into Jerusalem, and the colt, the foal of an ass. A beautiful picture. In one of the 18th century hymns, and the Christians there thought nothing of singing in commemorating this great event. "Be thou, O Lord, the rider, and we the little ass, that to the holy city together we may pass." They thought nothing of that. Try doing something like that today. It'd be an altogether different story, wouldn't it? So, the committee was very, very cognizant and sensitive to try to select hymns that would have a certain amount of liturgical propriety. Then also with regard to poetic beauty. I recall one of my German profs in St. Paul years ago defined poetry as schöne Gedanken in schöne Form, beautiful thoughts in beautiful form. And so we believe also that hymns, Christian hymns, should appeal to the imagination and to the emotions. The good poet passes great truths, and the great truths of God and Jesus Christ, scriptural truths, through his imagination process. There follows, of course, some picturesqueness and imagery. Witness, for instance, the hymn, "O Word of God Incarnate." It's the Lutheran hymnal 295, stanza 3. Notice the beautiful picturesqueness here in the imagery. "It floateth like a banner before God's host unfurled. It shineth like a beacon above the darkling world. It is the chart and compass that o'er life's surging sea, mid mists and rocks and quicksands, still guides, O Christ, to thee." Tremendous stanza. Tremendous imagery, is it not? It does something to you when you sing that and you read it. Then, of course, another point, we must hurry along, there's a universal Christian character. The Christian hymn is the product of the church universal, and one of the effective bonds between Christians today is found in the hymns, which are common to the peoples of varying faiths and creeds, for time has proven them true to the general feelings and experiences of Christians. So, very similar to the makeup of our present hymnal, the Lutheran hymnal 1941, of the 500-plus hymn writers represented, the following religious affiliations are also represented in this book. For instance, the Anglicans, out of that church we have 149. The Baptists, we have 11. The Congregationalists, 11. I'll just pick out a few. Presbyterians, we have 23. Reformed, 19. Roman Catholics, 13. Lutherans of all times and kinds, we have 215. So we have a spread here. And, of course, the same as in the Lutheran hymnal, when any hymn is taken or selected or considered for selection, naturally, the first thing to do is to look at that hymn regarding its theology, is it not? That's first and foremost. And this, of course, has been done. Some of these hymns have gone through the process of being altered, where the text didn't agree with our Lutheran confessions, with scriptural theology. They simply were altered to conform to our teaching. other considerations that played into it, in the whole selection of hymns. The committee, first of all, thought in terms of using texts which were common to both the Lutheran hymnal and the service book and hymnal. They examined these with the original intent of producing simply a core hymnal, simply a body of top-notch hymns, and maybe letting the individual Lutheran bodies select their own additional hymns, like the LCA, the ALC, and the Missouri Synod. So they started out with the idea of a core hymnal, a Stammausgabe, similar to that in Germany. But then the three-year lectionary came out, and then people said, well, we need more hymns. So 400 were added. Then there followed a hymn usage survey with approximately 2,000 congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church in America participating. And this manner of selection was employed. Hymns which were used once in the preceding 2 years by 50% or more of the congregations, those were included in this product. Then also came the request that maybe some gospel songs and spiritual songs be included, also contemporary hymns. And finally then, the number of 530 arrived. And that's how that happened, that we're up to that point. Now, some pros and cons quickly. What are some of the hymnal's pros and cons? As a result of the extensive testing process and input, the book possibly represents somewhat of a consensus, I think, among Lutherans in America. Two, numerous options are afforded from which pastors and congregations may make selections. The product might well be looked upon as a source book rather than a rule. There are a lot of optional things here, and maybe that's the way to look at it. This joint effort afforded the Missouri Synod opportunity to make a distinctly positive contribution to the hymnic resources of, say, the ALC and the LCA, because their service book and hymnal did not contain nearly the fine, possibly chorales and other hymns that the Lutheran hymnal has. And the book is substantially, of course, a new product, and it's not simply a revision of our present hymnal. We've got a much broader usage of the church year, the lectionary, the use of Holy Scriptures. It also allows for contemporary contributions, for after all, each generation has the right and duty to add its new song to the Lord. Well, let's take a look at some cons, because our time is short. Unfortunately, not every favorite hymn of every Lutheran is included, which is a very unfortunate thing. Granted that in the production of any Christian hymnal, not all hymns are included of the same high caliber, as a result of frequent requests not only from Missouri Synod, also from the ALC, some gospel songs, spiritual songs have been added, which some people may not necessarily like. There are some Negro spirituals. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? There's a spiritual, let us break bread together on our knees. Also, go tell it on the mountain. Some of you may have sung these in choirs. Then, there certainly have been some objections raised, too. Two, for instance, the optional use of placing the words of institution within the framework of a prayer form in what is called the prayer of thanksgiving in the communion section, and the words of institution and the use there. There's exceptions have been taken, objections have been made to the optional use of bringing the bread and wine to the altar together with the gifts of money. And someone has said that maybe there weren't enough hymns which spoke of the blood of Jesus Christ. And some said maybe and objected the fact that maybe the ILC had tampered with the apostles in the Nicene Creed. But in general, let me say that certainly the ILCW isn't infallible. It's natural that errors in judgment may have occurred in the long and difficult task of producing this hymnal. But I feel confident that the ILCW took the criticism seriously, has constantly made revisions, and is also presently doing so at this time, thus to make this book of worship a noteworthy contribution to the worship life of the church and a fitting expression, we hope, to the Viva Vox Evangelii, the living voice of the gospel. Well, here endeth the lesson, and we'll see if we have some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Grant. Any questions? We have about 8 minutes. I appreciate your bringing to our attention. These facts regarding the new hymnal are supposed to be matters. But I do feel that the laity have been kept in the dark completely, being the church as well. But some months ago, Christian News, and thankful for it, was kind enough to publish the hymns that will not be included in the new hymnal.
Yes.
To my surprise, I found that a number of Martin Luther's very favorite hymns are being omitted.
That's...
Therefore, I would suggest before our Senate will engage in a tremendous expensive program of printing this, in view of the economic conditions today, that we publish a list of the hymns that will not be included, and let the laity make an expression whether they approve of this or whether some of those hymns should be restored. I believe certain Martin Luther's hymns should be included, and there are many others that I saw in this list that I would disappoint if they were going to be omitted.
I can sympathize with you, empathize. I think any of us who are, you know, maybe 60, 70 years old, I'm including myself, you're 60, we're going to miss some of the old favorites. Absolutely. I know I am, but your suggestion is well taken. I think certain pastors have published it, and the ILCW might publish such a list, too, of those that have not been included. I would say with regard to the Luther hymns, well, Luther wrote about 37 hymns. He wasn't a prolific hymn writer. You'll find that the Evangelical Luther Hymn Book, the forerunner to the 1941, didn't have nearly the Luther hymns that this one, that the 1941 hymnal has, see. It didn't have all of Luther's hymns in it either. But scholarship then in 1941, that commission, why, they added a lot of Luther's hymns. In fact, we don't have all of them in the hymnal right now, not all of Luther's hymns. There are 38 about. But your point is well taken. I think you'd like to see the hymns that are omitted. You can see the problem, of course, when you've got, say, working with the SBH, and there are 600-some hymns, and then ours, and then trying to cull out. And it wasn't a negative process. They tried to retain all the hymns they could, still give the hymnic corpus a balance according to certain categories, see. It's a real problem. I can empathize with you. I can sympathize with you. I'm going to miss many good favorites, too. I really am, if this goes through. Yes?
From that era of the 1900s, what we call the Black Hymnal, there are many instances that I feel you need a smaller hymnal that just has the text of the song, that you don't always need all of the
I would say not at the outset. This could be a later thing, but taking a page from the present hymnals that have been and are being produced by various Christian bodies in America, invariably they all come out with a staff, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, four stanzas between the staves, the additional stanzas at the bottom, so that the hymnal serves a good purpose in the home. You know, the youngsters can play them on the piano and so forth and so on. We put out the worship supplement, the Commission on Worship put out the worship supplement in 1969, and we used simply tune text. We put in a tune and a text. Frankly, it fell flat. People didn't like it. Sad to say. Yes, sir. By all means.
When we land from drive 50, 60 miles and come over here and listen to the speaker and enjoy it, and I think you made a good presentation. But then we get 7 minutes for questions.
Yeah.
I don't approve of that. I'd rather have an important issue like this hymnal take a whole night for it, because I think it's very important. And I'd like to ask one question. Is 198, the song that we sang tonight, is that left out or is it...
I don't know.
Let's see.
If it has the same title, see, some of them might be changed. Let me just look. Listen, my friend, I appreciate your kindness. I'll be glad to stay here for 2-3 hours. I'd love to. Field questions. That'd be my joy and delight. But they've got a schedule, you know how it goes. And we started a little late. No. Okay.
Yeah. I'd like to ask how many laymen were on that little committee. So was on the basic committee, he was on the review committee,
mm-hmm.
His questions and answers in a Lutheran gentleman, no cigarette about
it. Uh-huh.
And why is that? Why are the laymen kept so
uh-huh.
quiet?
I can appreciate your frustration. I will say even the liturgics committee or our commission on worship does not know who the doctrinal reviewers are, for instance. The group that's reviewing this whole thing, both from a liturgical and hymnological standpoint, we don't know who the doctrinal reviewers are. Most of us don't know who the 10 men are who are sort of the interim reviewers. We don't know who that is. But let's be charitable and... I'm sure that the commission members, those names have been mentioned here and there, somewhere along the line. But I'll agree with you. There is a certain amount of lack of communication. I can sympathize with you, my friend, and it's too bad. Now, I will say to this, in defense of the commission, our commission on worship, that we'd like to have gotten a lot of this material out into the hands of the people, but the money was so short that... much of it couldn't be done, see. Really? Well, yes, sir. Anyone.
I have yet to find out what is wrong in front of him that we have, except maybe a word or two, like say, worms and then all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Why not revise our
okay.
You
okay.
Know, you said you're going to list some of the hymns.
Sure, sure.
I probably will too, because that doesn't bother me. Give us some money.
Mm-hmm.
My grandchildren are going to miss.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we have to conform to the...
Right, right.
why do we have to have an entirely new hymnal? Why don't we just maybe put a supplement in there, a change of words?
Yeah. In 1969, we produced a supplement, you know. Perhaps you don't recall that. Well, I suppose this is the mind of the church again. I think, well, about 25, 40 years, language changes... new developments, I'm not saying in theology, but speech and liturgical materials, and you know, that's the sign of the times, isn't it? This thing could be revised and updated. I'm sure there'd be some hymns dropped, perhaps. There would be some new ones added by popular demand. I can see your point. Right.